The entire city of Dallas is grieving. Police across America, which is a tight-knit family, feels this loss to their core.
Police apparently targeted by at least two snipers, described by the police chief as standing above ground, atop a parking garage perhaps. 11 people were shot in all. Three Dallas police officers and one transit officer are confirmed dead.
We still don't know all the facts. What we do know is that there has been a vicious, calculated, and despicable attack on law enforcement.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Hello, everyone. It is Friday, and it is July 8th, 2016, 5:08 on 720 WGN. Welcome to another business day, and welcome to another edition of The Opening Bell. We begin our Friday today with tragic news out of Dallas. We'll continue to follow all of the developments from there. As you heard there in the opening, President Obama has addressed the situation today. There's still an active situation ongoing in Dallas as police try to clear the city of potential booby traps and other possible explosives. Even President Obama there saying that America is horrified over the shooting of police officers there. 11 in all, 5 have been killed. That is the biggest law enforcement loss of life since 9/11, according to the Law Enforcement National Memorial in Washington, D.C. Again, 5 police officers are shot and killed in Dallas. We'll continue to follow that story throughout the morning and bring you the very latest as we get it here at 720 WGN, so stay with us. On the WGN Market Intel market desk this morning from around the globe, U.S. stock futures are wavering as caution creeps in ahead of this big jobs report out today. European stocks have pulled higher. Financials, they're finding a little bit of relief. In London, the FTSE 100 wobbling ahead of the U.S. jobs data, and oil prices have rebounded to a two-month low as well. All of that happening on the world markets today. Again, Dow futures seem to be wobbling this morning as we watch and see what is happening with the markets there. Yesterday, we saw some positive news from the economy. Private payrolls increased more than expected in June as small businesses ramped up hiring and fewer Americans applied for unemployment benefits. Russell Investments' Stephen Wood says the job numbers from yesterday suggest a rebound in growth following May's small job gains.
I think it's going to be about the Federal Reserve. They're watching the jobs report. The numbers in the mid-100s make sense, 130, 140, 150, 160. The ADP report that we got suggested that's reasonable.
The Labor Department again today releases employment data for June. Analysts forecast that American employers added about 173,000 jobs and that the unemployment rate ticked up to 4.8%. Let's bring in our financial expert and portfolio manager, Paul Nolte, who's with us from Kingsview Asset Management in Chicago. Paul is a chartered financial analyst at Kingsview. Paul, good morning. Happy Friday.
Good morning and welcome to the early part of the weekend.
Yes, exactly. The jobs numbers yesterday seem to be good. A little bit of concern for construction and manufacturing. But going into the big report today, things look positive. Why is there a little bit of nervousness?
Well, you know, we've had the jobs report gets revised 2 times. So we're going to get the numbers this morning, but they're also going to revise May and April. And with May's number being rather poor, they're looking at hopefully revising that number higher. And certainly, as was mentioned earlier, the Fed is watching this. The Fed is data dependent. And really, when you look at the jobs report, it's not so much the number, but it's the information around it. It tends to be very noisy. So even though the estimates were 175, when you get numbers that are significantly away from that average, and let's call it about 40, 50,000, that's when the market pays attention to it. So if it's a minor miss, markets won't do too much. But if it's a bigger miss, the markets will react. the expectation is that they will be better, and it will point to continued better economic conditions in the U.S. than around the world. And that's, I think, really what investors have been banking on all through the last couple of weeks as we start to see Brexit unfold.
And, you know, one of the other things that we look at closely is wage growth as well. There's been a little movement in that over the past 6 months to a year. Do we expect to see any movement in that area?
It should come in on a year-over-year basis about 2.5% or so. And when you look back over time, that 2% number has historically been on the low side. Normally, as the economy recovers and we see employment growth and we see people laid off much, much less, the wage pressures start to go up, and we peak out around 4. So we're now at 2.5, 2.7. We're not quite to that middle ground yet to where people really need to worry about inflation. It's part of the reason why our view has been inflation will remain low. It's going to be very hard for consumers to really ramp up their spending because the wage growth really hasn't been there as it has historically as the economy recovers.
As you look at the markets, especially the futures this morning, but specifically the numbers out of Europe, they seem to be holding their own, even in the wake of Brexit.
They are. The one part of the market that has been absolutely decimated have been the financials. Less so here, but certainly in Europe. And they are going to be, the bullseye is on them at this point as far as trying to survive what's going to happen as they renegotiate everything, contracts, you know, all the various financial conditions and how they're doing business is likely to change over the next couple of years. And investors have just sold those willy-nilly, if you will, in Europe.
As we continue our morning business conversation with Paul Nolte of Kingsview Asset Management, Paul, coming up in our next segment, I want to talk to you a little bit about job growth as we continue our focus on that. But a quiz for you. Where do you think the city is with the biggest wage growth over the past year? There's a new survey out. I'll give you the quiz when we come back. And perhaps we can also talk a little bit about the Federal Reserve minutes. So we'll do that as our conversation continues here on The Opening Bell. It's 5:15.
Hey, it's Your Money. Want to work on a presidential campaign? You're going to find a lot of openings on Donald Trump's and Hillary Clinton's websites. And career builders Michael Irwin says most of them are temporary.
Are you willing for the next couple of months to get behind somebody and help them either win or lose? And then when that win or lose happens, you're not even guaranteed a job.
He worked on President Bill Clinton's first campaign. You'll need a Social Security number, a thorough resume, a clean social media profile, and maybe a security clearance. Daria Albinger, ABC News.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome back to the program. We're with our Friday business conversation. Paul Nolte of Kingsview Asset Management is with us. And Paul, before we went to the break, I sort of gave you a little chance to think about the quiz. There's a new report about where wages are growing the highest. Any guess on where the highest growth came last year in the U.S.?
I would have to say it's the technology-laden areas of the U.S., which would be California, certainly. But surprisingly enough, Massachusetts is another center for technology as well. And to a certain extent, the Chicago area here is been developed as a big tech center. So I would say those three would be leading the charge.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The number one was Sunnyvale, Santa Clara, San Jose, California, 7.4% wage growth over the last year, followed by Sioux City, Iowa, believe it or not, at 6.7%. So what is you mentioned the tech aspect of it. They are fueling wage growth there. Why can't that be replicated in other places?
Well, you know, there is a limit to, again, the amount of jobs that any one industry can have. And when you look at the flip side of it, the parts of the U.S. that have been hurt the most have been those that have been associated with the energy sector. So as the energy sector declines, you see states like the southern tier of the U.S. or the Dakotas suffer, and 3 years ago they were flying with jobs. So it doesn't necessarily, it's a snapshot in time. Technology tends to pay up for workers. They're looking for that those employees that have that background, that have that knowledge base, and as those businesses grow and develop, they're looking for those employees, and it doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to be in Nebraska or, you know, in Ohio. So they want to have as many people as they can for that type of business to grow, and certainly it's going to be around those big population centers.
Yeah, the least wage growth, by the way, border states like Arizona, Texas, New Mexico, also Louisiana, saw Nevada also in there as well with some of the least job wage growth over the past year. So since we met last, Paul, the Fed minutes are out. Anything from those that surprised you?
Not really. Again, it was more of the same. We're data dependent. We're concerned about the jobs number that was recently released, again, from the minutes. And then this was also in front of Brexit, so the Fed decided to kind of wait and see. Since those data points have come out, the expectations on Wall Street are that the Fed will not raise rates until maybe mid-year 2017. So they've taken everything off the table for this year. So anything here, and that's part of the reason why, looking at this jobs report, if we see a significant growth in jobs and probably in the order of about 230, 240 plus wage growth, we could see those numbers come back on again. We'll be very, we probably will see the market sell off on a very, very strong jobs growth, because that's really not in the numbers right now.
The Federal Reserve governors were very, very concerned about Brexit, as we see from the minutes, weren't they?
They were. And, you know, what's interesting is Brexit, if you look at it from the Fed's mandate, and the Fed's mandate is inflation and job growth in the U.S., Brexit doesn't have a huge impact directly on the United States. It has a very large impact, obviously, on Europe, and by extension that way through our trading partners and our trade, but not necessarily directly on the U.S. So it's a disruptive factor for the U.S., but not one that is going to drive employment or drive inflation. So it's interesting when the Fed has now, over the last year or so, gone well beyond their mandate and look a lot more globally when they are trying to set monetary policy, and that's very, very different than their historical norms.
I saw a few words that were jumped off the page: anxiety, also caution. One of the other words that I saw was a slow movement forward. All of these things, worries was another one that I saw quite frequently. All of this is not really necessarily supportive of, you know, positive movement on Wall Street.
No, not at all. And what's interesting about that, too, is that, you know, monetary policy has been very easy for the last 8 years, 7 to 8 years. And through all of that, we've gotten economic growth in the 2, maybe 2.5% range, and we're starting to see that come down a little bit here as well. And it's the only thing that's been in the playbook is the Fed or central banks around the world. What's been missing from the equation has been fiscal policy, where Congress gets involved and does a big spend, or where Europe gets involved and does an infrastructure deal or something along those lines. So it's been kind of a one-trick pony, and it's been all around the central banks around the world. And the part that's been missing is action from the various parliaments, Congress, et cetera, to really try to jumpstart the economy. I don't think what we need is more money and more liquidity in the system. We have plenty at this point, but we need something more right now, and that does not come from the Fed.
So as we head into the weekend, what do you like? Are you still heavy on bonds, or are there bargains in stocks to be had?
What's interesting is everything that's bond and bond-like, so utilities, consumer staples, have really been bid up here as investors run to parts of the market that have been safe and have provided a little bit of income. Parts of the market that have been neglected during this recent rally have been the healthcare sector energy has come down a little bit here. And then, too, the international, even though, again, with Europe in the banking side in Europe struggling here, we're starting to see a little bit of value in the international side. And I think over the next 3 years or so, it won't be a U.S.-centric market, the S&P 500. We'll be looking overseas for some of the better returns.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I heard a few analysts talking about emerging markets this week. I know that's an area that you like looking at as well.
It is. It's the cheapest part of the globe. It's also the riskiest part and the most volatile part of in the investment. So you really don't want to load up on the emerging markets. But we're starting to see a little bit of outperformance now by emerging markets. And we think if we can continue that for the next 6 to 9 months or so, we may see a 3 to 5 year period where emerging markets outperform after underperforming really for the last 5 years or so versus the S&P 500.
All right, Paul Nolte, Kingsview Asset Management. Good chat as always. Have a great weekend.
Absolutely. Thank you. You too.
All right. And you can find more about Paul at kingsview.com. You can also subscribe to his Nolte notes, kingsview.com/WGN. And those notes come out regularly. Good advice on where you should be putting your money in the markets.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome back to the program. 537, and the business of health takes center stage now. It is being called the Cancer Moonshot, and last week, hospitals across the country gathered for a summit where they heard from the Obama administration's leader on this issue, Vice President Joe Biden.
I firmly believe we can do in the next 5 years what would ordinarily take 10. And think of what that will mean. Think of how many people you know who are saying, you docs who are saying, doc, I just want to make it one more month to see my daughter get married. Doc, if I can just make it another 4 months, I'll be able to pay off the house and my wife will be okay when I go.
The goal of the Cancer Moonshot is to encourage action and collaboration in conjunction with the namesake national initiative that seeks to double the rate of progress on cancer research over the next 5 years, a la the Moonshot, our focus on going to the moon during the Kennedy years. And we did it in less than 10 years. There's a lot of optimism about this. And we're joined this morning on The Opening Bell by Dr. Robert Wynn. He's the director of the UIC Cancer Center. And Dr. Wynn, let's start first by just a very simple question. Are you optimistic after meeting with your colleagues last week? Are you optimistic about this possibly happening?
I am incredibly optimistic. And I thought that yesterday the kickoff was not beyond the symbolism was the fact that we had over 270 participating parties throughout the country. And I think that it not only talks about the kickoff, but that there are people all over the United States who have a similar interest in sort of really fighting cancer. And I was amazingly thrilled by the vice president comments. But I was even more thrilled by the number of people throughout the country who got involved.
As a child of Apollo, of the moon era, I like the idea that this is a moonshot. We're describing this as moonshot because it describes something that I think sort of rallied the entire nation behind a certain goal. Do you think that is what's needed to solve this cancer crisis?
Absolutely. I think that just like putting a man on the moon took not only the best engineers we had, the best mathematical minds we had, but it took the people, right, to support it and urge the engineers on to create it. I think in a likewise fashion, we clearly have the bioscientists, the bioengineers, the molecular guys. We have a lot of scientists, but we really do need, again, just like with the Apollo, the spirit of the nation and the people and our communities to sort of continue to push us to the lens where we can create these great things and ultimately, hopefully, cure cancer.
What is it that you think is standing in the way? Why haven't we been able to get a handle on this and do this yet?
Yeah, I think that there's several reasons that come off the top of my head of why we have not yet done this. One is that we've been fairly fragmented. where there are lots of efforts within the academic realm, there's some efforts in the private realm. But I see that being an issue. There is a lots of other things that just kind of matter, right? The economy, you know, people just trying to, you know, get by from day to day. I do think that despite those challenges of resources, despite the challenges of just other issues that are important, that in spite of that, I think that what Vice President Biden did was to remind us and awaken us of the potential we have as a people of when we get focused around an issue of being able to solve that problem. And so I think, again, yesterday was a great kickoff, if you will, to reminding us and awakening us again to the greatness of the United States and our ability of when we put our mind to something, how we can actually tackle it and typically, you know, come up with something good.
Is there are there medical reasons, though, that are the hurdles? Are they medical reasons that we just haven't answered certain questions yet, too, that are standing in the way?
They're definitely always medical, and they're scientific reasons, right? And so although I will tell you from where we were, an example, where we were 20, 30 years ago on lung cancer, no one would have predicted where we are today, right? So 20, 30 years ago, when you see a spot on someone's lung, and typically you may get a biopsy and say it's cancer, and then what we tell them is, hey, have you had that trip to Disney World? Look at what we're doing today, right? And that's only in a couple decades. We're able to screen for lung cancer, and the National Lung Cancer Screening Trial actually proved that you know, we can reduce mortality by 20% by just simply screening. The early days of screening in lung cancer, for example, were abysmal, right, with a large male clinical trial. So we're making some progress. I think with the advent of the molecular sort of approaches, the molecular targeting therapies, an example of lung cancer is looking at lesions around KRAS or EGFR mutations or these types of deals, these sort of molecules. We're able to now target them and give you more effective therapy that treats that individual patient. So it's true. There are certainly always going to be limitations in understanding on even molecular and cellular level. We don't understand everything. We're getting a better grasp on it. For example, we don't understand, you know, whether all people respond to the same therapy the same way. I mean, there are definitely going to be some obstacles. And in fact, while we're coming up with precision medicine tools and while we're coming up with proteomics and metabolomics, there's still things in the field that just are going to inherently be difficult to sort of understand.
I know somebody who is a representative for one of the drug companies and had a conversation with him recently. He said that we'll never, ever cure a disease again, that there will always be manageable diseases because of the money involved with drug. I thought that was really just sort of demoralizing. Do you agree with that, or are we headed in a different direction?
I don't agree with that. I agree with that in as far as much as the reality is we will probably be able to do like we are now with HIV AIDS and other things like it, have people living with the disease. But the reality is if you live with the disease till you're 98, then that's actually pretty good. So our job is as researchers and as clinicians and as translational folks who want to take this really to our patients is to come up sometimes with a cure would be great. But even if we don't have cure, how do we have people live longer, healthier lives and be able to live with cancer, but be productive citizens? That, too, is a win.
Then it goes back to the drug issue. And, you know, some of these drugs are very, very expensive. That has to be something that we address, too, isn't it?
That absolutely. And in fact, the cost of the drugs, again, are a little bit, as we talked about earlier, in the sense that when you develop these miracle drugs, the problem now inherently is that there's a lot of focus on development of the miracle drug, which is good. But beyond that, that means that those miracle drugs typically are now currently available to very few. So the next trick beyond, and this is why I love the moonshot, because the moonshot isn't about just the technology. The moonshot goes beyond the technology and saying, how then do we actually think about the cost? How do we think about the delivery system? And how do we get these miracle drugs and miracle therapies out to our underserved populations, which predominantly carry a disproportionate amount of the disease? That, too, is the next wave of innovation for me. So if there's anything in moonshot that I'd love for it to happen, is for it to not just get caught up in the technology, but how the technology can actually then create a space for us to also do what I call the phase two thinking, and that is, how do we get those miracles cures, potential miracle future cures, out to populations that are in rural areas and urban underserved areas? That, too, I think is a real opportunity for population health and innovation.
So now that we've had this summit and the vice president's talked and there's this money available, will we have NASA engineers come in and help us get the work done? What is, in layman's terms, what's going to be the immediate work?
I think the immediate work now is with that kickoff is that it has come to all of our attention, academic medical centers, especially academic medical centers, as well as community medical centers, that it's probably time to work more together. A concrete example of that is, as a result of this talking around moonshot, the University of Chicago, Northwestern, and the University of Illinois are getting together around a precision medicine initiative that was started by the president. Part of that precision medicine initiative obviously has and carries the potential with it to figure out issues around cancers. Now, that wouldn't have happened with all the attention by the president and the vice president of getting us to sort of say, quit working in silos to solve big problems. You solve big problems by working in teams. And I think that kickoff yesterday really emphasized that we're not going to do this by one institution or one smart guy. It's going to be multiple people, just like it was when we put a man on the moon.
Dr. Robert Wynn is the director of the UIC Cancer Center, talking about the Cancer Moonshot, which is underway, involving oncologists all across the country to try to find a cure to cancer using that mentality of sending a man to the moon.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
It is 5:50. Welcome back to the program. Dow futures pointing upward just a bit this morning, up about 27. NASDAQ and S&P just a bit higher as well. Let's get the latest on commodities and ag news this morning. And Orion Samuelson is with us. Good morning, Orion.
Well, good morning, good friend. And we're looking at a market that maybe is rallying just a little bit to end this terrible week for soybean prices, and not much better for corn. But I've been saying for years, look out for weather rallies, because weather rallies disappear as quickly as they arrive. And we certainly, back in early June, saw one of the earliest weather rallies I've seen in my years of covering ag markets. But boy, did they disappear this week. We saw soybeans fall well over a dollar. Yesterday alone, soybean futures down 4.7% to their lowest level in nearly 2 months. And the sharp drop on beans also affecting corn. But it settled close to unchanged because traders locked in some profits from a surprise rally that happened early yesterday with news that the corn crop in Brazil had been lowered about 7 million tons in their estimate on that. So, but November soybeans yesterday down 48.5 cents. Back in June, we saw beans nearly at $12 a bushel. And yesterday, they closed in the November new crop beans at $10.24¾ a bushel. After the drop early in the day, the December corn ended a quarter of a cent higher. In the livestock trade yesterday, cattle futures closed lower again because we're now into what we call the Goldman Roll. Today is the first of 5 days in which funds in the CME's live cattle and lean hog markets that track the Standard & Poor's Goldman Sachs Community Index periodically sell or roll August-long positions into October. Well, that started really yesterday as August closed down a dollar and October closed down 85 cents because they'll be selling the nearby and going long into the distant months. So it's a weather market that has gone south because weather, Steve, has been ideal. We have seen some dry spots, but in the past week to 8 days, we've seen a lot of rainfall over critical areas that needed rain. So,
well, and you know, we were kind of bragging about the good weather earlier this spring, weren't we?
Well, yeah, and we always get a weather rally, but never that early because June, the crop is just coming out of the ground, really, and normally we get a weather rally in July when it's pollinating time for the corn crop, and then August is a critical month for soybeans because we need rains in August. That's when that crop is made. But to have a weather worry way back in June, and the thing that really bothered me is I talked to several farmers who have old crop. That means they still have corn and soybeans in the bin that they haven't sold, and they didn't sell on that one, and now we're looking at a much lower price. The one other note that we're looking toward in Washington, where they cultivate a little differently than we do on the farm, is the possibility that we could get a Senate vote on the National Food Labeling Act. Because last Friday, Vermont became the one state in the country that said, these are the rules if you're selling food products in our state. And with the national spread of our food companies today, you just can't have one state determining that, yeah, you can do this, you can do that, and other states can't. But now the vote is headed for a final vote in the Senate, and if it passes that, expectations are that the House could follow suit, and we could get it signed fairly quickly. The other thing I have to mention is tomorrow morning, Max Armstrong will be broadcasting from the I&I show that's been going for about 30 years in Penfield, Illinois, down south of Champaign. This is not the new equipment. This is how we farmed 50, 60, 70 years ago, and people still love to take a look at old tractors and old farm equipment. And so it's a four-day event, started yesterday, continued through Sunday. And tomorrow morning, Max will be there to broadcast the Saturday morning show.
All right. Orion, have a great weekend.
You too, my friend.